It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an epidemiologist about Ebola and find out if fears of its spread to the U.S. are realistic.
First, the ability to listen well comes with huge benefits, both on the job and in personal relationships. But even back in 1987, before the age of digital devices, people could only remember 10% of what was said to them in face-to-face conversation after a quick interruption.
Today, companies and coaches are zeroing in on the power of listening and why it matters. There are seminars, there are books about the skill, and how to be a better listener.
Sue Schellenberger joins us now. She recently wrote about how to improve your listening skills for the Work and Family column, which she writes at the Wall Street Journal. Sue, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Veronica. Thank you.
Sue, what do we know about how well people listen in their day-to-day lives?
It's been oddly neglected. I was surprised when I reported this story that for all the training that goes on presentations and speaking well and putting forth a good verbal skill set, very little is said about listening. People aren't taught to listen. They don't assign much importance to it, and they tend to think that it's a lot more important to talk. As a result, I think that we're talking past each other a lot in the workplace.
And what kind of things prevent people from paying as close attention as they should when other people are talking?
One of the things is you're always worried about what you should be saying next. You're listening only with the intention to reply, as Stephen Covey said, and you're trying to think of the best comeback or thinking about the next topic you want to bring up. Another problem is what Julian Treasure, who's a really popular TED speaker, calls filters. Conversational filters, that is, you have an assumption going into a conversation that you know that what somebody's going to say, whether it's going to be accurate or worth listening to, and whether they're, you know, someone with a contribution to make. These filters keep us from listening. And in other cases, we're just distracted. Of course, you know, distractions are multiplying apace, and we're often thinking about who's buzzing us on our cell phone or texting us.
So that statistic I read at the beginning about how people only absorb a little bit of what they hear after an interruption, do you expect that that's probably much worse now that we have cell phones and, you know, all kinds of things like that to distract us?
I suspect it is. There's not much really good empirical research in this field. I found having to cite a 1987 study as the latest study on conversations, but a researcher at Rockhurst University in Kansas City took a look at how much time people spend listening. And with college students, about 24% of the time is spent listening. That's down from 53% in 1980, the last comparable study. I think we can assume the trend is similar for the population as a whole. We're really not getting much practice anymore, and we assume that when we listen, if we learn something, we can Google it and find it again if we forget it. So we really don't pay that much attention. And, of course, if you're in a face-to-face conversation, you can't Google it. It's lost. So it's kind of a poignant topic, actually.
Yeah, so what are we losing by not being better listeners?
I think number one in my mind is the quality of relationships you may have in the workplace, the ability to really learn from each other. People who are good listeners who I interviewed for this story said that they were often surprised by what a colleague had to offer if they really sat down to listen. Problem solving comes with good listening. One of the best writers on this topic is Bernard Ferrari, who wrote Power Listening, and he insists that if you're a good listener, you'll get much more quickly to the right solution because you'll be hearing what everybody has to offer. You won't be just resting in your own complacency or your own assumption. So quite a bit lost here.
You interviewed someone for the piece or quoted them saying that it was a authority figure saying that they assumed because they were this person of authority that they were supposed to do the most talking. Is that true in most companies, do you think, that people with power think they should talk the most?
Well, I think managers think that's part of their job is to always have the answers. And that's why people are constantly interrupting each other in meetings. It's why they're racing to finish each other's sentences. I think it's a very common assumption. And the manager you mentioned actually went through many years of coaching to get over that. And he told me he cited several examples where he thought he had been able to hang on to really good employees by listening deeply and helping them solve the problem they were having rather than just glossing over it and giving out, you know, some kind of boilerplate advice.
And if we're not the boss, is there a sense that, hey, we have to impress our boss and our colleagues by talking and being authoritative, and that's more important than listening?
That's absolutely true. That's a really good observation. You're always trying to make an impression. One anecdote that didn't make the story was about a young attorney who was doing all briefs quite well, did good research, he spoke well, but in meetings he never seemed to be listening. There was no sign, no active, you know, feedback, no eye contact. And the partners in the firm asked the coach to work with him. They said, look, you know, this guy just isn't even tuning in. He's not listening during meetings. I see no sign that he's taking anything in. And working with this young attorney and associate in the firm, the coach found out that he really hadn't had the social skills in his upbringing. He had come from, you know, a deprived, disadvantaged family. And as she worked with him and said, you know, you're going to have to learn to do this. It's not just talking. You have to listen. He did begin to polish those skills, and he became eventually, he's on his way to the partner track now. Mm. So you really can tell if somebody's listening to you or not. I think that may be the big surprise here for many people. You think people don't notice, but they do.
Oh, that's interesting. So if we want to be on the track ourselves to being better listeners, what is a good way to start?
One of the most humbling things to me was that a good listener will truly be ready to receive. And that means you have to empty out all those filters. One woman recommended doing that kind of a brain dump. You know, she said, before I have an important conversation, I write down everything I'm thinking of, all the things that might distract me, and exactly what I should do on each when I come back to work. And then her brain is clear. Sometimes it helps to make a list of topics you want to cover or questions so you're not always worrying, oh, what am I going to say next? One challenge that a sales coach advised was, plan that you only want to listen for one-fourth of the time. Really good discipline to follow
to keep
yourself from chattering. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you said listen only 25%? Did you mean only talk 25%
only,
of the time?
I beg your pardon, talking okay. 20% of the time. 25%.
Good listening,
yeah,
Rob.
Wow. I'm practicing.
Yeah.
I'm practicing. Yeah,
thank you. That's exactly right. I Freudian slip there. So just, you know, try to draw the other person out, and that will turn your focus to the other person where it belongs.
Now, this kind of brings up an interesting point. Rob and I were talking about, you know, as talk show hosts, this seems like an occupational hazard that we have to think of the next thing to say while someone else is talking, because in a regular conversation, if there's a, you know, a pause, that's okay. You know, no harm, no foul. But if you're on the radio, you don't want these gaping pauses between every conversation. Is it possible to do both?
I think folks in your profession have a remarkable ability to almost double track on conversations. And you know, among, you know, the best interviewers, including yourselves, I've seen you're really able to listen really well, pick up nuances, funny things, but also have another question in mind. So I guess that's a special skill that not everyone has.
Well, fortunately, most of us aren't on the radio all the time. Do we need to be more accepting of that kind of pause to think and consider and formulate the next thing that we're going to say to make room for us to listen?
This may make you squirm as it did me when I was doing the reporting. I was, you know, the coaches were pretty uniformly advising, you know, use the power of the pause. Mm-hmm. I said, what? The power of the pause is that if you're just willing to sit there and, you know, and look attentive and wait, the other person will typically reveal more. And that manager we spoke of a moment ago who was helping employees solve problems, he said he found that they would dig deeper, you know, for the way they were really feeling about things or what they were really dealing with or what's the real obstacle here. He said the power of the pause, even, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 seconds to let that person just think about it, you'll get to more depth, he said, and it really worked well for him.
So employ the power of the pause. What else can we do if we're someone, you mentioned active listening before with the young lawyer who had to show signs that he was listening. Are there signals that we give toward listening?
Right. I asked about this, and I think one of the challenges in listening is that our minds race far faster than anyone can talk. I didn't realize this, but on average, we think at least twice or three times more quickly than anyone can talk. So our mind is naturally, you know, gyrating around, jumping from here to there. So taking notes can help. Some people, you know, doodle. I mean, I talked to a person who interviewed a lot of job candidates. He said he secretly doodles because it helps him focus on what's being said. Another thing that can help is to keep eye contact. This will help you stay engaged. Paraphrasing what the person just said is a popular method. You know, we've all heard this from marriage therapy to encounter groups, say back what you think was said and make sure you got it right. this is fine if it's not overused. I mean, sometimes it can be a roadblock and deter the conversation. But my favorite is sort of the clarifying question. And not, you know, well, what do you mean by that? You know, not with an attitude, but rather, tell me what was really most important about that, or, you know, where would you like to go with this? To really get the person to focus what he or she is saying, the questions really do help you stay engaged.
We're talking right now about how to be a better listener with Sue Schellenberger. She's the creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about how to be a better listener with Sue Schellenberger. She is the creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column.
And we want to hear from you. Are we a nation of bad listeners? Are you a good listener? Are you a bad listener? Call in at 800-642-1234 and let us know if you have tips on settling down and paying attention to what the other person is saying. Again, 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And we go now to Reed in Madison. Hi, Reed.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. I'm a professional storyteller. And in response to the thought you just asked about sort of how do I reward myself for listening, if I'm telling a story or if I'm coaching someone to tell a story, I want them to listen. And if I've listened really, really well, I might give myself a chocolate chip cookie or something later on. What I wanted to share with in the conversation is when over the years, as I've trained other storytellers and been asked what's the most important thing or what's the first thing a good storyteller has to do or be, I tell them they have to listen and they have to be a good listener. And in doing so, as the teller tells the story, the teller listens to an internal voice that the teller then is then relating to the audience. So the teller models good listening to the other people in the audience for the story. I wanted to also mention and ask the guest to respond to this thought. In my own individual life, when I've interacted with people through language and practiced active listening and asked other people to active listen with me, what seems to me to happen is as I listen to Sue talk, let's say, and I wait, I open my mind to her thoughts. And rather than composing a rebuttal or a refutation or some other response while she's talking, if I just let my mind stay open, I internalize her thoughts, and then those thoughts become more integrated with whatever my experience is when I do offer a response. And if we're problem solving or something like that, my thesis is the net result is more apt to be a very much more integrated blend of our two experiences, so we have more resources with which to solve problems.
Great. A couple of fantastic points there, Reed. Thank you for that.
Really.
And, you know, rewarding himself with a chocolate chip cookie, of course, is a good idea, too. But Sue, do you want to start with the last part of that about if you're truly listening, you can take things in and integrate them with your own thoughts? Do you feel like that happens?
Beautifully said, Reed. I think that's so true. What I found was that when employees actually were taught to listen to each other, I interviewed several who came back from these training programs and said that they were having better conversations with colleagues. They were coming up with better solutions. There was less conflict, fewer disputes. And I think that's a testament to the point that Reed makes. You know, we truly open ourselves up to change and to understanding, and that changes us, and it also produces a better outcome. It's one of the reasons that, you know, the famous business scholar Peter Drucker recommended that the boss mostly spend his time listening because he's going to make better decisions as a result. You learn and you change. And it's a terrific observation.
Reed, thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. We go now to Richard in Minneapolis. Richard, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. What do you think about this listening conversation?
I think listening, if you listen to people, then you're not thinking. You know, most people are thinking what's going to be their response when they're listening to someone, so they don't really hear everything they say. And you meet a lot of people who think they know everything already, so they don't need to listen. But if you quiet your mind down and just listen, then you truly hear what a person says.
So don't assume we know what's coming out of the other person's mouth. Listen to it, Sue, is what he's saying?
That's a really great observation, Richard. That's really true. And I think that's some of the best training in listening is exactly that. It's almost like a meditation, isn't it? You clear yourself out to hear, to take in without prejudice or judgment. And you're open to new knowledge and new learning, as Reed said. I think it's I like the way you said that.
And there are people you quote that liken deep listening to a kind of meditation, a kind of mindfulness. Is there something to that?
There is. There's a Google engineer has written a book called Search Inside Yourself that's taking off like a wildfire in certain Western companies where employees are being trained in this program of mindful listening and other skills. And the mindful listening is very much like the active listening we've all heard about in marriage therapy. They just sit and listen for 3 minutes without reacting or saying anything and then repeat back to each other what they thought they said. One guy came out of such a course and said that his marriage got better. His wife said, "Wow, you're really listening to me differently now." Instead of just saying, "Yes, honey, I heard what you said," you know, really listening deeply. So I think there's a lot of power here for improving relationships.
Well, Sue, that reminds me, I was thinking probably most of us don't think of ourselves as bad listeners when some of us clearly are. How do we diagnose this in ourselves?
Oh, boy, I tell you, after I did this story, I became so self-conscious. And I realized how much, I thought I was a pretty good listener and I interview a million people a week, but I wasn't. I was jumping ahead. I think, the extent to which you're able to tolerate a pause, for me, that's one thing in a conversation. The extent to which you are, like Richard said, in a quiet state where you really are listening and not thinking. And the quality of your conversations will go up, if you're listening well. So if you notice you're not really getting much out of the conversations you're having, maybe you should take a look at yourself and your listening.
Going back to our caller, Reed, from a couple moments ago, does it work to model good listening if you're with one of those people who you feel is not a good listener? If you just model it yourself, does that get you anywhere?
It's a great idea. I think it does if you're the boss. I've been inside companies where the CEO was a very good listener, and it just trickled right down through the ranks. So I do think it's tough if you're... You have to go for the long-term goals if you're a good listener among poor listeners. And I think you can see it as your secret weapon. You can listen really well to people who don't listen well, and you can learn more and more. You'll gather more information in your conversations. You'll be smarter. You'll solve problems better. And eventually, the virtues of good listening will become clear to others. But it's very tough if you're, if you're in a company and you're not the boss and you're listening well and others are not. You get crowded out of conversations and meetings.
Yeah, how do you confront someone politely in that situation at work or at home?
It's really hard. They may just start talking at you again, right? I think it's, using the pause and, staying very calm. Try not to be reactive. I mean, step number one in all the training that I looked at for this story is just try not to be reactive. Just be. Just open up. Be receptive. Take it in. Listen. That in itself has a kind of transforming effect, especially on a close relationship. And as you do that, the other person will realize, oh, something's going on here that I'm not participating in. And beyond that, it sometimes can really help to get some therapy or some training.
Well, Sue, we're going to leave it there. It's so much to chew on, and it's a great topic for a radio host as well.
So,
thank you so much.
Yeah, both are great listeners. Thanks to you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Sue Schellenberger. She is a creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column. She recently wrote a column about how to become a better listener.
And you can still share your thoughts. So you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. That'll be your weekend assignment. Tweet us your thoughts on listening and... if you've taken what you just heard from Sue and have tried to put it into practice in your daily life. I don't know. I think I can take something from that. You?
Absolutely. Yeah,
what?
There's a lot.
No, I'm just messing with
you. All right, we're going to have to work on that, Rob. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to a food writer about vegetarian entrees.
First, two American aid workers who contracted Ebola in West Africa are being airlifted to the United States for treatment. Soon after that news broke, social media sites exploded with people expressing fears that it could spread here in the U.S.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is the deadliest on record. According to the World Health Organization, more than 1,300 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have contracted the disease since March. More than half of them have died. So, should we be worried about an Ebola outbreak here in the U.S.?
With us now is Donald Francis, epidemiologist with Global Solutions for Infectious Diseases, a nonprofit global health organization. He was part of a World Health Organization team sent to inspect the first ever Ebola outbreak in 1976. Dr. Francis, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, can you tell us about your first encounter with the Ebola virus in 1976? What struck you the most about this disease?
Well, that, you know, for someone who's, I kind of started my career getting into dangerous bugs accidentally, and this one got your attention very, very quickly in terms of the extreme mortality of it. We didn't know at that time exactly the transmission. We had to figure out all the transmission and interview all the survivors and the family members to figure out how it was transmitted. Which, for anyone working there, you want to know how to transmit it so you can protect yourself. So in the meantime, you're in these, you know, monkey suits with your respirators and in the heat of tropical Africa trying to figure out, by interviewing patients and survivors, exactly how they got their disease. And it very rapidly, you see, that it was very, very close contact. It was not airborne or aerosol, but it was... the downside is when you did get it, the disease was really very, very severe with, you know, depending on what outbreak you've then and subsequently, somewhere between 50% and 80% mortality.
And what makes it so severe?
The bug, probably because it's not been selected out for humans. It's not a human bug. And those kind of things get adjusted as the eons go by. Because that's when it essentially kills all the hosts, and that's not a very good parasite. Your parasite wants to keep the host alive for a while so it can replicate and go elsewhere. But this one probably does that in bats, and they're very well adjusted. But when they get to any larger animal, it just kills them all.
Well, now we've got this Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the largest ever. Why did this one spread so quickly as compared to ones we've seen in the past?
Well, that we really have to determine, but I suspect is that this is an area where it had not had Ebola before, and always in the first, much like since I was on the first outbreak, it just kind of cruises on. You don't really recognize it as being as dangerous as it is until it gets way out of control, gets into hospitals and spreads in hospitals or close contact quarters with people, and so it's. Not recognized, and so people don't run for the bush, and you get more and more cases, and then you have funerals, and people wash the body, and then they get infected from the virus outside the body, and so it goes on and on and on. And then the next years you get it far fewer because humans get educated about it.
Well, today the news broke that there are two American aid workers who have Ebola. They apparently were sick in West Africa, took a turn for the worse, and the powers that be decided to airlift them back to the United States for treatment. And with that news, social media erupted. People's fears about this virus also erupted along with it. How concerned should we here in the United States be about an Ebola outbreak?
Well, usually these things take care of themselves very quickly because they're... I mean, if you compare this with HIV, it's totally different. Here you have HIV, which is indeed has a higher mortality than Ebola, but it's got a long, long incubation period where it's silent. Ebola's got a short incubation, so you see the cases very quickly, and so it essentially the fire burns out very quickly. And so you know where it is. You can see where it is. It's not this underground, hidden outbreak of other kind of diseases like HIV.
Well, how does Ebola spread?
It really is. It has... high replication in the body, and especially in any parts of the organs of the body where it's replicating primarily in the liver, and so it gets very, very high concentrations in the blood and oozes out through your normal orifices, but also any time it goes very long, then you start having this blood oozing from everywhere. and there's really thousands and thousands of viral particles per drop of blood, and so it just gets lots of virus, gets out, and then people get it on their hands or get it in a cut and probably put it in their eyes or scratch themselves. The skin is probably pretty good at protecting, but any opening in the skin, any scratch, or getting into your oral or other mucous membranes, it'll start replicating.
Right. From what I've read, we should be less concerned about this because it does spread from, as you say, bodily fluids. It's not something where it's as an aerosol transmission, so that makes it less worrisome to people. Do you agree with that? Are fears unfounded that we need to be worried about, you know, it running rampant?
No, it's the danger is when you get into, you know, situations where it where using sharp instruments and such in hospitals, and that in the laboratory in the hospital, people with needles and syringes, on any mistake like that. Indeed, in the work that I've been involved in, some of the very, very good laboratory workers slipped and poked their glove with a needle, and that'll do it. You can get very, very sick. So for the average person, this is not something that is going to spread wildly.
Now, as we've said, Ebola has a very high mortality rate, but not everyone dies from this virus. Do we know why the people who are surviving are surviving?
No, at least I don't. We tried to figure some of that out, but some people have, like I think any infectious disease, that some people just replicate so much better, and you get more and more virus there. And that's true of all diseases, actually. Ebola is shocking because so many people do die, whereas most of the diseases we deal with, a rare person dies, and some people don't even get any symptoms whatsoever. So it's a matter of how much virus is multiplying.
Is there a risk in bringing these two patients from Africa back to the United States, or is this something that people should just, you know, be quiet about and, I guess, compassionate about?
Well, this is the risk is trivial. This is about as high class isolation as you'll ever find. CDC has set up this exact system to do this, and indeed, it started when we all started going off in these epidemics of what are we going to do with any of the people you send off to investigate the outbreak, and who's going to take care of them. And so you had to get a system to be able to take care of them, and so these units are set up to do exactly that. And it's not the community that has to worry. It's the healthcare workers, and they're all trained to do this, but they have to be very, very careful taking care of these people.
But then I've seen headlines that seem to, you know, designed to induce fear, quotes like, Ebola is just a plane flight away. Is that scaremongering?
Well, I think if you look around the world, there's many, many viruses that are a plane flight away, and not to mention you've got HIV, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from your doorstep. So we've got bugs around the world like that. We just have to use our brains and avoid them.
Unless I want to ask you about a possible vaccine, there is news that trials could begin in September. What do we know about a vaccine for Ebola?
I mean, they've been playing with doing experiments with Ebola vaccine for years, and I'm not. No, they're talking about actually doing some human trials, but I'm not familiar of how far along it is. And I've worked on vaccines for years and years, and they take time. And they're not. And how do you do a trial for an Ebola vaccine except in a monkey that you can challenge? Because you're not going to get any human volunteers to take the vaccine and then be challenged with the virus to see if they're protected. And you don't have enough people to do a large trial in West Africa because there's not enough disease to test it. So it's a challenge.
So this is not, as you see it, a quick silver bullet?
No, no.
Any advice you would give people who are traveling? Is there anything people need to do differently or just maybe calm down?
No, not really. I mean, I think these are very isolated situations where they get in hospitals or into funerals or into families, and the odds of people getting involved, unless you're a healthcare worker, who is exactly what we're talking about, people flying in are healthcare workers, and they get exposed in the hospitals. And if they're there, the interesting thing from an ethical standpoint is that those people are there, and when you're a doctor, you have to take care of them, as I had to do with the Ebola patients in Sudan, and you that's your job, and sometimes you have high risk of infection, and that's what we have here.
Well, thank you so much for joining
not
us.
Not the general population.
Great.
Sure, my pleasure.
That was Donald Francis, epidemiologist with Global Solutions for Infectious Diseases. He was part of a World Health Organization team sent to inspect the first ever Ebola outbreak in 1976. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. It's time now for Food Friday. Today, vegetarians are everywhere, and food writers like Michael Pollan are encouraging even the meat eaters to cut back a little and explore more plant-based foods. Wasn't always this way. When the modern vegetarian diet started in the 1960s, it was way more limited. Today, though, most home chefs like to have at least one vegetarian recipe in their back pocket.
Food writer Joanne Dembski is with us to talk about this transformation and attitude towards vegetarians and about the staples of the vegetarian diet. She's a freelance writer and a former staff member for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and for the most part, she's a vegetarian. Joanne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Joanne, you've been a pescatarian. I guess that's someone who eats some fish, but it's the rest of your diet is vegetarian for 40 years. Why did you
Correct.
Decide to remove most meat from your diet?
I initially did it to lose some weight, and then after a few months I did lose some weight, but I also felt so much better that I just decided to stay meatless, and I've never turned back.
And we mentioned you eat some fish. There are a lot of different kinds of vegetarianism and shades of vegetarianism out there. What are some of the different ways people approach that?
Well, it's pretty much some people just avoid red meats, and often that's because they want to lower their cholesterol. Then you have people like myself who I just eat the seafood. You also have complete vegetarians, and those would be people who don't eat any of the meat products. And then, of course, you have vegans who don't eat anything that comes from animals.
How would you say that attitudes are different today than when vegetarian first popped up in the 60s?
Oh, I think the attitudes are very different. I think today it's fairly mainstream. Many of my friends and a lot of my family members are now going meatless, and I'm also hearing that a lot of teens are going meatless. They're just deciding to do it for health reasons and maybe because they don't want to hurt animals.
And how have the options for vegetarians changed since, it got big in the 60s?
There's so many more things that are available for people to eat. There's all the different vegetables, there's a lot more vegetables and fruits that weren't available years ago. You've got all the different dairy products and grains, a wide variety of cheeses that weren't available years ago. There's even meat substitute products like veggie burgers, things like that. Some people, if they do miss eating meat, they go towards those products and try them.
What do you think about getting your protein from a meat substitute? Do you think that's, adequately carrying the torch for vegetarianism?
Well, I think you certainly can get your protein from those products. I personally don't think they are often taste very good. I prefer to use dairy products, beans, grains, things like quinoa, nuts, and seeds.
Before we get into some recipes and entree ideas, it just sounds like eating vegetarian is a lot more fun and flavorful than it was at the outset.
Oh, it is. When I first started eating meat, going meatless years ago, there weren't a lot of options out there. You just kind of had to try to make dishes yourself or take recipes and just remove the meats. Now there's so many different products that are available, and it's not just the blocks of tofu marinated in tempeh or something like that. There's just a lot of different products out there. And there's a lot of, if you go to Asian stores, there's so many different options and seasonings that can really make these dishes taste better.
Well, let's dig into some of the recipes that you shared with us. The first one is beans and barley lemon apricot quinoa. So a lot going on there already that sounds exciting. Mm-hmm. And you've got as your base the quinoa, which is a grain with a lot of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that one?
Quinoa is really a great food for vegetarians, and I really feel it's very important. In fact, I just recently read that it was first cultivated over 5,000 years ago, and that the Incas used to call it the mother of all grains. And it's also one of the few plant foods that's considered a complete protein. It's also gluten-free, contains iron, B vitamins, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, vitamin E, and fiber. So it's good in so many ways for people. And it tastes great, too.
And talking...
The recipe, the apricot quinoa recipe, it also has so many other delicious things in there. It just really complements the quinoa, the dried apricots, the red bell pepper, the currants, the pine nuts.
Well, speaking of quinoa, Joanne, that's an ingredient that people are finding more and more available in stores. And reading your piece on this, it used to be something like even a red pepper was exotic, and you could only find it in different parts of the country. And people were careful to write their recipe books to not include that kind of ingredient in some cases.
Right. When I did the interviews, that's what I was hearing. You know, I don't honestly remember 40 years ago if I was finding those things or not. I just ate whatever vegetables I could find. But these food writers were saying that they had a terrible time with trying to be creative and to find good recipes. But fortunately, that's all changed now. There's so many different options.
So you've got the quinoa and the apricots in this. How does it come together? And how long does something like this take to cook? Because that's a point that comes up a lot when you're trying to talk about vegetarianism. People say, I could never do it because of all the chopping and the waiting. How long does this take?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't actually test that particular recipe, although I certainly wanted to. But I'm guessing, just by looking at it, it doesn't take long at all to put it together because, you know, it only takes a few minutes to chop up a bell pepper and pine nuts and currants. Those are all ready to roll. So I think it's more or less just combining the ingredients and having them prepped and put them together. And it also had a dressing on it that could easily be made in advance, which would be a time saver.
You also talk about the rise in availability of eggplant and people figuring out more and more what to do with it. How has eggplant jazzed up the veggie options for us?
Well, there's all these different kinds of eggplant available, for one. You've got the Japanese eggplants, the baby eggplants, and those are really have slightly different tastes, and they're very interesting looking. So I think a lot of people are using those just like they're using portobellos as kind of the main ingredient in their recipes to kind of make them special and kind of give you a meat substitute of a sort.
Well, you've got another recipe that you share, this one for penne and pasta with eggplant and mozzarella. Mm-hmm. What was your experience with this one?
I did make that one, actually. That was very tasty. I liked it because it had the two different cheeses in it. And the combination just really went well together. And I was also able to, my husband is not a vegetarian, so I was able to give him some by just putting some roasted chicken on it, and he said he thought it was great.
So it's got the mozzarella. What's your other cheese in there?
Mozzarella and, let me see, I think it was a Gruyere.
Oh, that'd be really good.
Cheese. Yeah.
I'll go with Gruyere
cheese. Yeah. It was good. That's one of my favorites, and I've never met a cheese I didn't like, so anything with a lot of cheese on it is always going to be a plus for me.
So a lot of people will continue eating meat, not want to go full vegetarian, but make the case why even the meat eaters should pay attention to vegetarian recipes, throw them into the mix sometime.
Well, it's just such a healthy way to eat. And by eating more plant-based foods, you're going to have more energy. Your cholesterol is likely to lower. And you're also going to find out there's a lot of great meatless dishes out there. A lot of people, I think, especially people who are really fixed on eating, especially red meats, they just feel that they're not going to be satisfied if they don't have that hunk of meat on their plate. But in reality, eating things like the eggplant and the portobellos and maybe even the meat substitutes, you can get a great meal out of it and be so much healthier. So you can still have that steak when you want to, maybe just not as often.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Joanne, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Joanne Dembski. She's a freelance writer, former staff member from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.